It's 2:08 this Tuesday afternoon, and I got to get to this. There is an interesting story here in the Tribune about how what some parents are doing, what some students are going to be doing. That, you know, you've heard about these pods, these teaching pods that some parents are setting up to either supplement the e-learning or take the place of it, I think, in some cases, where they hire a teacher or a tutor and teach a group of kids and all the parents chip in. That's one of the answers that some parents are turning to, if you can afford it. There's also this 56-story apartment tower in the Streeterville neighborhood that is the Optima signature skyscraper, built only a couple of years ago there on East Illinois Street. What they're saying is, you know, gone are the days of the one-room schoolhouse, but maybe the one-room or one-suite sort of apartment could serve as a place for your pod. You provide the tutor or the teacher. You can rent one of our suites, and we'll set them up for e-learning. Pandemic pods, they're called, or micro schools. And that is one of the things. They're actually marketing this as the way to, help parents out if they're interested, that they could do that. They envision that a couple floors of it will be just students and teachers. They've got like 500 units or something, and because of, you know, the situation right now, not all of them are rented. So they say this could be a new purpose for some of these empty units. That's the marketing plan there. I want to also talk about something as we talk about schools opening, and some of them are this week. I know the Catholic schools, many of them have opened. Lockport schools. I heard Hinsdale went hybrid this week. They just sort of changed that, but I think they're open. Not positive, but Arlington Heights as well. And next week, another kind of group of schools begin, both at the college level and the elementary level. And then every week that goes by, you've got more and more schools kind of opening up to Labor Day when CPS and others begin. CPS, of course, with the all e-learning model. I want to talk to Karen Conti, too, because one of the things some parents are seeing, especially at the collegiate level, and when students first log on to the portal and say, hey, you know, I'm going to sign up and register or whatever you do, the first day of school, I'm in advance of that, they're making some of them sign these waivers. And these waivers are basically, you know, they're saying that you accept some risk, that if you catch COVID, that's on you. That's the way I'm reading it. Let's ask attorney Karen Conti about these kinds of things. How you doing, Karen?
Doing well, Anna.
I just, you know, this is a new world. And when I saw that, I just thought, wow. And you know, when I sort of looked in right into the article here, even the professors, as they tried to access their inboxes or just kind of get online to start, you know, lesson planning, they saw these little boxes and these long, like, legalese they had to read through and then check the box and sign something. And it's basically, I think, a waiver. Have you heard of these? Seen these?
Yes, I have. I mean, everyone's making you sign them. I mean, it's just, you know, from your hair salon to, to businesses and now schools. And basically, they're just trying to CYA. And you understand that they're having people congregate, and they're worried that there's going to be lawsuits. And basically, these waivers will say, I acknowledge that there's a risk when you have more than one person in a room. We acknowledge that, you know, you're choosing to come to school and come into a classroom, and that it's a possibility that you could contract this virus, and that you are giving up your right to sue in the event that you do contract it. And, you know, these waivers will generally be enforced. But the bottom line is that it's going to be difficult for people to sue anyway. And I know I've said this over and over, Anna, but how would you ever be able to prove definitively that you contracted COVID from any particular place? What if you contracted it at a party or on public transportation or from one of your children or from a friend? There's just no way to prove where you got it. So these waivers are to protect the colleges, but I'm not sure that you would have a right to sue anyway if you contracted it.
You know, there's an article in Bloomberg that just basically advises students not to sign it. And I just want to get your take on it. They're saying students don't realize their power. A landlord, a university, an employer, if they ever give you a contract to sign and you're not comfortable with it, negotiate it. Don't tick the box. Don't sign it. Start with the university counsel's office or the registrar's office. I mean, I don't know. Do you really want to go through those hoops in order to fight this kind of thing?
Well, you know, my guess is that they put this together for a reason. And if you don't sign it, they may refuse to sign you up for classes and allow you in. So I'm not sure if they're going to take it that far, because the schools seem to me to need the tuition money, and they want to move on and they want to educate kids. That's what they're in the business of doing. But yeah, it probably would be important for students to get together as a group and do this rather than just individually, because, you know, you're going to fight a battle there. And what if you get lost in it and you don't get to sign up for classes? And the bottom line is, anyway, you're going to take your precautions. And again, do you really want to bring a lawsuit because you get sick and when you don't know where you got it?
Do you think there will be a flood of lawsuits, waiver or not, about this kind of thing? And will they like ultimately be successful? What do you think is going to happen there, if you had to predict?
I do think that. And remember, this whole pandemic bill that they're trying to pass in the federal government, part of that bill is an idea that for at least a period of time, businesses cannot be sued for contracting COVID at businesses and schools and all kinds of other public places. So that's going to be hopefully, you know, for the schools and the businesses, that's going to be a federal law. Mm-hmm. So these waivers may be not even necessary because you couldn't bring a lawsuit anyway. Yeah, a woman just sued her husband died in a meatpacking plant in Aurora, and she's brought a lawsuit saying that he contracted it there. You know, let's see what happens with that suit. I think it's going to be difficult again to prove where you got it.
Yeah, I bet you're right. And you mentioned this before with hair salons and nail salons and barbershops and things like that. Even like a month or so ago, whenever they opened again, you often had the waiver pushed in front of you before you got your nails done. And that just was that's the way it is.
And as long as the business is following protocol, you know, you'll see that people are wearing masks, that they're using hand sanitizers, that they're only operating every other salon chair. And all of that stuff will go into the idea that they've done all they can to meet the standards that the city and the state have imposed. And as long as they're doing that, they're doing the best they can. You know, you're not guaranteed that you're not going to get the virus walking into any place. You're just not given that guarantee under the law or under any realistic circumstances.
I want to ask you about a couple other things. Karen, can you hang on for just a second here?
Because sure.
We have there's a Chicago business owner who's suing the city over the looting. But then you also have the whole report issued from the special prosecutor, Dan Webb, on Kim Fox's office. And a lot of talk about what that means. It was written in fairly legalese, but I think we can all understand what he said and what he meant when he said it. But in terms of legal ramifications, and others are saying, well, what does this mean for her license? Will that come into question? There are no criminal charges, of course, but there was a lot of pointing in her direction of the way things were mishandled in that case. And just kind of what that means. I want to get your perspective. It's 2:16 here on WGN. Back with attorney Karen Conti in a moment. Okay, back with attorney Karen Conti here as we talk about Kim Fox and the special prosecutor's report of how her office, the Cook County State's Attorney, handled the Jussie Smollett case. And I mean, if you may no longer care about Jussie Smollett, you may not care if you ever hear about Jussie Smollett again, but I think the issue for some of us all along has been her office and how that's an important piece of the justice system here in the county. And when there are issues with how things are handled, we should care about that piece of it. And I think that, look, the ultimate report here says that there were issues with discretion. The words mislead appear, false statements appear, abuse of discretion, operational failures. Never speaks in plain terms and said lie or lied to the public, because that is ultimately what she did when she said several things about the way the case was handled. Jussie Smollett, all charges were dismissed, and there was like this emergency court hearing. It got on the docket in emergency fashion so that media couldn't come in and take a look at things. And suddenly we heard that his community service counted for, you know, that was it, time served, and off he went. But the things she told the public were not exactly what was happening, this report found. Karen Conti, how do you see it?
Yeah, I think it's scathing against her. Of course, we don't have the full report yet, and that will be made public, I'm quite certain. But, you know, basically the report found that she recused herself but shouldn't have appointed somebody to go ahead and prosecute. Once you recuse yourself, you're not supposed to have anything to do with it at all, and the report says that she did. Second, the misrepresentations. She said, you know, that thousands of cases were handled this way. That was not true. She said that the $10,000 fine was the maximum that they could issue. That was not true. He said he had no criminal background. That was not true. And the report went on to say that the dropping of charges was, they couldn't figure out why the charges were dropped. There were conflicting accounts within the prosecutor's office. Some prosecutors said they were surprised and shocked that the charges were dropped. So what we have here is just kind of the appearance that this was mishandled and that we were lied to. And again, you're absolutely right. I really don't care about Jussie Smollett, but what I do care about is having a prosecutor's office that's transparent and that we know what's going on. And this, whatever happened here, it just looked really, really bad. Now, the report found that did not find that someone influenced the decision. There was no heavy hand or a bribe or even a telephone call. So that wasn't in it. But how was it handled, and why wasn't this handled the way other cases are handled? And I think it's something that is going to be a problem for her.
You know, one of the interesting facts here is that Kim Fox was swept into office. Anita Alvarez had been perceived as someone who was not telling the truth about the Laquan McDonald tape and had kind of slow rolled charges until the mayor sort of signaled that it was okay to talk about it. They paid off the family, and there are all these things that happened, and that suddenly, whoops, the videotape's out. Now there are charges. And that sort of, it just stunk. And I think that Kim Fox was seen as this reformer who came in, and I think that's sort of the surprising piece of this, fast forwarded now, is that the thing she ran on when it came to transparency, this is a damning report that shows that that's not how she's operating the office again at all. I mean, when she talks about, how many times did she say, as soon as he became a suspect, initially he was a victim, so it was okay to talk to his sister and him and everybody else. But when he became a suspect, I broke off all communication. That is not what the special prosecutor's report ultimately found, is it?
No, that's right. And she continued talking. And again, you know, I mean, you could even ascribe like no bad evil will to her on this. But when you are a prosecutor, I mean, this is like this is the biggest group of lawyers in the state. Okay. There are a lot of lawyers. Their job is to prosecute the law. Their job is to be beyond reproach. And there are ethical rules, at least three of them, that say that lawyers cannot lie to third parties. And you can roll your eyes all you want, but we are held to a higher standard. And she's held to an even higher standard because she prosecutes people. She prosecutes people for lying and stealing and murdering. And at a time when we have a record high of crime and in our beautiful city, she's got to be beyond reproach. And I think this is a serious problem for her.
You know, and the other thing that she said was she recused herself. And we all knew that was sort of air quotes around the recuse, because we later learned that even though she had gone out public and said, well, you know, I recused myself, and so I was no longer handling anymore because of these conflicts, these obvious conflicts. Turns out the special prosecutor's report also found pretty clearly that that was not the case. She didn't. She handed it to, like, her second in command or something, and she was right there. You know, that's not recusing yourself, is it, in the terms of legal
sense? No, well, right. And, you know, if your boss recuses herself and then says, okay, employee, now you handle it. Well, of course, the employee is still employed by the employer. So that's not a recusal. And there should have been a process by which someone else independent from that office would continue that case. And again, you know, start to finish, sometimes it's just the way it looks that's bad. And I know, Anna, if you remember that morning where he pled guilty, it wasn't even scheduled for court. No one even knew. And he kind of went in a back door and the case was dismissed and he didn't even have to plead guilty to anything. And it was done in a way that it just stunk to high heaven. Mm-hmm. And we can't have prosecutors' offices act that way, especially in a high-profile case. Again, he doesn't get any special treatment, nor does he get any worse treatment. But when the world is watching a case, I mean, this was a national case, people were watching, this had to be handled perfectly, and it wasn't handled, not even close to perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what sort of, you know, you get from this bad taste in your mouth, that it wasn't about equal justice in the eyes of the law, that there was definitely special treatment here. And then who else gets special treatment? Is it, I mean, how does the office work if you're just sort of doling it out according to who contacts you and who influences you? That's not really the way it's supposed to be carried out. Justice, her response has been, the report puts to rest any implications of outside influence, which is what you had mentioned earlier, Karen, or criminal activity, which, okay, I mean, that's a low bar that the state's attorney is not guilty of criminal activity. Thank you. I mean, oh my gosh. But it's, that was the response you got from her. It just, not the sort of, look, we need to do better, and our office, you know, there were a lot of mistakes made here, and something's got, I mean, look, top to bottom review. And I mean, I don't know, isn't there another statement that sort of goes one step further?
Yeah, I mean, there's a thin line here between, you know, what you do politically and what you do as a matter of what's right and wrong. And the report goes on to say that that they're referring her to the licensing agency. And again, I referenced there's three rules that say lawyers can't lie. They can't obstruct the administration of justice. They can't engage in misrepresentation and fraud. And, you know, the findings that Dan Webb had in that report basically say that that happened. And so she's going to have trouble, and she's going to have to deal with the issue of whether they're going to sanction her or reprimand her. I don't think they're going to disbar her for this, but that's going to be something that will distract her from doing her job, a very important job now at this time in the world of crime and how Chicago, you know, what's going on here in Chicago.
Yeah, no question about that. So ultimately what I'm hearing from you is you don't think that this, when she goes before the IRJC, which does this automatically go there about her license, or is that something that someone has to bring there? Like, what happens?
Well, Dan Webb in his report said that he was going to refer her, which means that he will fill out a complaint. And we have an ethical obligation to report other lawyers' misconduct in certain circumstances. So that's probably what he's using to say that he is going to have to do that. And if he didn't do it, the judge in the case probably would do it as well. And again, you know, that doesn't mean anything. It's going to be investigated. They're going to come up with a determination. And but it's going to be a distraction because she's going to have to defend herself in a forum. She's fighting for her law license and not to have it taken away either temporarily or permanently. And who wants a state's attorney who's got that distraction?
Yeah, I get that. I get that a lot. I understand that, I should say. We've got this one last thing. I just have a little bit of time here, Karen, but I do want to ask you about it. We discussed it on the show yesterday, and I just I wonder what would happen to this. There's a Chicago business owner, Waleed Muhammad, who had a convenience store looted here in the city two times. He says it was $300,000 to repair the store after first being looted, and that it took an awful long time for police to respond, and he's suing the city to pay the bill. And I wonder, is that the right way to do it? I don't know, but he is doing it, and I just wonder how likely he is to be successful with that.
You know, Anna, I don't think he's going to be successful. And again, you know, I'm not saying from a moral standpoint. I mean, it did sound like the police took a heck of a long time to get there. I feel really bad for the guy. But there's a kind of an immunity that when you sue the police, they're almost immune from everything unless it's egregious and willful and extremely negligent. And arriving at a late time is usually not something that you can tag the police for in that regard. So although it sounds like something that you should win on, he's probably not going to be successful.
Interesting. Thank you, Karen. I love hearing your thoughts on this kind of stuff. And it's there's a lot to go through these days. So thanks for the time this afternoon.
All right, Anna. Take care.
Talk to you soon. Karen Conti, attorney Karen Conti, Conti Law. You can also hear her Sundays. She always says have dinner with Karen Conti because that's what time she's on here on WGN Sunday nights around dinner time.